From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. The critical role of the chief of staff, it defines every presidency, as we know from the author of The Gatekeepers, Chris Whipple of Old Greenwich, who's written the now definitive work on it. And we've got another White House chief of staff joining us who got off to a slow start of the Carter administration, but then he was brought in after they had no initial chief of staff, turned things around for the Carter administration, and was completely floundering. That's Jack Watson. He's our guest. And he's going to look at the Trump administration, where chiefs of staff come and go on a regular basis. I think we're on number three. He's going to talk about how he turned around the Carter administration from an executive perspective, helping get the presidency moving. He'll talk about his prediction of Mick Mulvaney, the latest chief of staff under Trump. We'll talk about the famous Carter malaise speech. We'll ask him what he thinks about other chiefs of staff and what I'm going to call the lightning round of quick answers. What makes a successful chief of staff? Can the Trump administration be successful without a successful chief of staff? We'll ask Jack Watson, White House chief of staff under Jimmy Carter, tonight. I've always wondered, when he was elected governor of Georgia, he stood up there and he said, the time for racial discrimination is over. I think it's one of the most brilliant, visionary, gutsy things ever said. Why didn't we get any of that kind of rhetoric?
The fact of the matter, I think, or at least my opinion of the matter, President Carter is almost incomparably effective in town hall meetings where he can stand up there, make a statement, explain a position, explain a policy, and then open the floor for questioning from citizens. That's where he's most effective. He was not as effective as a speech giver from a podium on television.
Yeah.
He was less comfortable with that, and I regret that. I think that skill, that talent, that some other Kennedy, for example,
Reagan,
Reagan had it to a fare thee well. You know, you take your presidents in the way they are, and you optimize their qualities, and you kind of work around their limitations. One of President Carter's limitations, in my opinion, was that it was not his nature to give the soaring rhetorical speech. That's not him.
Let me ask you this, and this is a little bit wonky, but I was always interested in it. He did a lot of reform in the Georgia government structure, getting rid of commissions and things, supposedly making things more productive. He came in with a goal of government reorganization. Of the federal government. Did he accomplish that, do you think? What was the goal?
Absolutely, he accomplished it. Back to Georgia, I'll be quick about this.
Okay.
But the Georgia government hadn't been reorganized since Governor Richard B. Russell, later Senator Russell from Georgia, had done it in the 1930s.
Yeah.
So over a period of almost four decades, the government had sort of grown topsy-turvy. The things that should have been consolidated, the services that should have been consolidated were not. And Carter undertook to reorganize Georgia state government and did in a very successful way. It barely passed by one vote in the Georgia Senate, but he got it. When we got to Washington, one of the things that we had worked on in the transition at his direction, he wanted us to do background work on this, was whether or not we should have a Department of Education, whether or not we should have a freestanding Department of Energy, which we'd never had, and what we could do in terms of what's called zero-based budgeting. I don't want to get too wonky here.
I remember that, yeah.
But the president believed, both as governor and as president, that each year the agencies of the government need to come in sort of from a zero base point of view and defend what they're asking for. Don't just keep adding on without any justification for what you're proposing. So that's what he did with the government. He also, and this is much less known, but it's so significant, He reformed the civil service system of the federal government. He created what's called the Senior Executive Service, SES, which is a part of the civil service since Carter that rewards extraordinary service, exceptional service.
Meritocratically based, right?
Absolutely. And that was something that we had worked on and thought about and talked to a lot of people about, had presentation of facts to him on it, and it got passed.
Let me ask you this. You have a statement in one of your writings, building a cabinet, some assembly required. The amount of turnover that has been in the Trump administration, what is the impact of that, and how long does it take a cabinet secretary to get up on a learning curve and be effective?
Good question, Jim. Incidentally, I'm amazed by your by how much you know about all these things. It's wonderful. Thank you. The president's relationship with his cabinet is crucial. The really successful president is going to have a good relationship with his cabinet members, and the cabinet members a good relationship with not only with the president personally, but with his senior White House staff. My role as Secretary of the Cabinet was to be the president's principal liaison with the cabinet members. It's very important once you've selected your cabinet members, after vetting them carefully for their experience, their expertise in particular subjects, their executive background, their executive experience in running big organizations, and so forth. Once you've got them in place, it's crucially important for them to know what the overall goals of the administration are so that they can play their part in the implementation of those goals. And the really successful administration is one which doesn't lose people every year, 12 months, 18 months, keeps people in place, benefiting from their experience in the job, benefiting from their experience on the Hill, their relationship building that starts with every new administration. You don't want to lose it. It takes time for those things to be developed, for those relationships to be developed, for the expertise to be developed, and so forth. So turnover in the cabinet, as well as turnover in the White House, is anathema to a successful presidency. It simply won't work. And it sometimes takes months to get a cabinet member confirmed.
Yeah.
So it's crucially important for the president to form his team first wisely and well, putting people in places where they can operate successfully based on their backgrounds and experience and skills, and then by means of communication with them, back and forth, listening as well as talking with the cabinet members, executing your policies, whether international or domestic, so that the turnover that has occurred both at the cabinet level in President Trump's administration and even to a greater degree in his White House staff is a great impediment to his being successful.
Interestingly, he doesn't seem to get that either. Now let's go to something that you know, is a seminal moment. Everybody talks about the malaise speech, which he didn't use the word malaise in, but that people forget that actually got a positive response. And then the administration stepped on it by firing five cabinet secretaries, two of which, Joe Califano, HEW, and Mike Blumenthal, Treasury, I've interviewed, are highly impressive people. What happened?
That's a complicated question that requires more time than we have to talk about it. But at its essence, it was a matter of adjusting, making adjustments to the team so that the team would work better in a coordinated way. You're right. Mike Blumenthal and Joe Califano are extremely able men. Were then, are still.
Mm-hmm.
The interpersonal dynamics, the ability to work with others, the ability to sign on to the president's priorities, even if you have a disagreement with them. That's another thing that makes for a successful presidency. A successful president wants to hear from people who disagree with him.
Mm-hmm.
The good leader wants to hear the contradictory points of view in order for him to be fully informed. But once the decision is made, then you have two choices as someone working for the president. Either implement the policy, march forward and do it, or if it's of sufficiently negative consequence to you, resign. those are your only two real choices. So the so-called Malay speech was a speech in which he was sort of examining the American psyche, American situation. It was extremely well received when first given.
Yeah.
And it was only later that it came to be known as the Malay speech. But he, those changes that he made in the summer of 1978, those were the first changes that had been made to his cabinet.
You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell from our flagship station, GL Radio, WGCH and WYBC. Coming next, the author of The Gatekeepers, Chris Whipple of Old Greenwich, who's written the now definitive work on it. Chris Whipple is an acclaimed writer, journalist, documentary filmmaker, speaker, a multiple Peabody and Emmy Award-winning producer at CBS's 60 Minutes, ABC's Prime Time, and most recently he was the executive producer and writer of Showtime's The Spymaster, CIA, and The Crosshairs. His groundbreaking and newsbreaking book, just revised for the Trump presidency, Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, was on our show for the original release. And this is out in paperback, and it's already number 9 on the bestseller list. Welcome back, Chris.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Let me ask you quickly first. I wanted to compare with a bunch of other chiefs of staffs, but we're kind of out of time. But Clinton, to me, was a chaos president in the beginning. And how is it that he was saved versus Trump?
Trump's not the first president to come into office full of hubris. And I think that Clinton thought he could run the White House by himself. Mac McClarty, his childhood friend, very capable guy, was his first White House chief. And it wasn't Mac's fault, but Clinton failed to empower Mac McClarty in a way that could make him effective.
And he was a great guy, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, just a wonderful guy and very popular guy and very smart. But again, Clinton didn't get it, didn't understand the job. It was a year and a half in, he was really kind of stalled. And there was an intervention led by Hillary Clinton, a kind of intervention, Hillary Clinton and Al Gore. And they had their eye on Leon Panetta. They thought Panetta could be a really effective White House chief. They flew him to Camp David and essentially almost locked him in a cabin with Bill Clinton. Panetta didn't want to be chief of staff. He loved being OMB director. But as he put it to me, he said, "I found myself in a cabin with Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, and Tipper Gore. I knew it wasn't going to be a fair fight." And Bill Clinton looked at him and said, "Leon, you can be the most powerful, the best OMB director in history, and if the White House is broken, nobody will remember you." And when Panetta left that cabin, he was the next White House chief of staff. And he really did turn the Clinton White House around. You know, Bob Reich described him as an iron fist inside a velvet glove. Panetta really turned the Clinton White House around.
Do you think is Trump temperamentally and intellectually unfit to be president? Or is there a chance he could break your paradigm with an entrepreneurial president that somehow innovates and succeeds through total chaos?
You know, that's way above my pay grade. I'm not sure that anyone can answer that question with any real certainty. But this is a 71-year-old man who has always done things his way and who has functioned, again, with the model of the 26th floor of Trump Tower. It's worked for him. He divides, he demonizes, he disrupts. As Leon Panetta put it to me, this is a guy whose modus operandi is to pull the pin on the grenade, roll it into the next room, and wait for the dust to clear and see what happens. We've never had anybody anywhere near the Oval Office who operated that way, much less somebody with the nuclear codes. So it's just hard to imagine that, first of all, there aren't a lot of Jim Bakers and Leon Panettas to go around.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to imagine a chief of staff who could really significantly change Donald Trump.
Okay, let me ask you this way. Now, you've got your gold standard you call Jimmy Baker, and you've got some failed ones, Don Regan, for instance, under. Where would you put Priebus and Kelly on the continuum?
If you'd asked me a year ago, I would have said that Don Regan, who was Ronald Reagan's second White House chief, who was a real disaster. It's no coincidence that the Iran-Contra scandal happened on his watch, for example. Never would have happened on his predecessor's watch, Jim Baker's. I would have said that Regan had a lock on that title, his worst chief of staff. Now I think he's got some competition in the form of Priebus and Kelly.
So you're putting both of them at that end.
I think they've both got a shot at this. And Kelly, you know, in my mind, Kelly really is the greater failure in an odd way, because Kelly was empowered in a way that Reince Priebus never was.
Yeah.
Kelly was given more authority than Priebus, or seized more authority, however you want to look at it. To some extent, his failure is even greater to some extent. And he's, as I've said before, it seems to me that he's failed even by his own very narrow definition of the job, which was making trains run on time in the West Wing. And now the trains, of course, are off the track. You look up a year later, and the staff secretary has got no security clearance because he's accused of beating his wife. You've got 30 other people without clearances, including the guy who's in charge of Middle East peace. You've got everyone headed for the exits, and a White House that is really broken. So I think that, you know, sadly, I think that I like Reince Priebus, but I think that he and Kelly are contenders for that title.
Do you feel that that Kelly's about to go, or inevitably going to go? And with all your knowledge, and would you have somebody that should have a crack at this in mind?
You know, I really couldn't. I don't want to try to pick his successor. And as I say, it's, you know, there just aren't a lot of great candidates who could manage this guy, Donald Trump, in my mind. It's hard to say how long Kelly will last. I'm not so sure that he'll be gone quite as soon as everybody's predicting, because he's with Donald Trump. You're in the doghouse one day and out the next, and back in and then out. And I think that, as I say, I think that it's, I'm not sure that there's anybody in the wings that Donald Trump has in mind who could step in and be more effective. You know, I've just finished saying that he's one of the least effective, and yet this may well be mission impossible with Donald Trump, who is who he is, and as you say, maybe intellectually and temperamentally unfit for office. There's nothing anybody can do about that.
Now, of course, if you read your book and buy into everything, doesn't this say that Trump presidency has very little chance of being successful?
You know, having said that, let me just point out that it took Jimmy Carter 2.5 years to figure out that he needed to appoint just to appoint one, much less empower one. Ham Jordan never had the title for the first 2.5 years, and Carter thought he could run it himself. It took Bill Clinton 1.5 years to figure out that he needed to empower a White House chief in the form of Leon Panetta. So it's not hopeless. It could conceivably still happen. But as I say, it only took Jerry Ford 1 month to figure out that he couldn't run his White House like the 26th floor of Trump Tower. And I don't see any evidence that Donald Trump has learned that lesson.
You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell from our flagship stations, Yale Radio, WGCH, and WYBC. Coming next, Jack Watson, the best ex-president ever. And we've got another White House chief of staff joining us who got off to a slow start of the Carter administration,
But then he was brought in after they had no initial chief of staff, turned things around for the Carter administration, and was completely floundering. That's Jack Watson. He's going to talk about how he turned around the Carter administration from an executive perspective, helping get the presidency moving.
We got killed because of the oil prices going up 12% a month between 1979 and end of 1980. I mean, that was just blowing everything. But until then, we were moving toward a balanced budget.
Yeah.
And still doing all the job creation things and the Urban Development Action Grant things. And that's why I say the serious students of government and its effectiveness from administration to administration, they'll get this. You know, in time, they'll get it, and he'll come up in the historic analysis. That's what I think.
I think you're right. And
one of the things that characterized him, and this is both a strength and a weakness.
Yeah.
As you were saying a moment ago, his own worst enemy sometimes. Jimmy wanted to know what we should do about this problem or that problem. What should we do? And when those of us who were putting together the information for him would say, "Mr. President, this is what we should do, mm-hmm. but it's not. But it'll cost too much politically, and so let's don't do it." His almost invariable response was, "No, let me worry about the politics. if that's what we should do, I agree. We should do that. The Panama Canal being a perfect example of that." It was a venture of high risk to bring Sadat and Begin together,
yes.
because the probabilities of failure there were sky high.
It would have been the whole administration. I mean, it would have
if they were sky high. But Carter thought he could do it. Thought it should be done. Thought he could do it. And
he pulled it off.
And he pulled it off.
You know, I've been through the Carter library, and the Middle East thing is amazing because you get a sense of how hands-on he was. He's got handwritten notes drawing maps. I mean, could you imagine Trump or Reagan or someone getting down to that level?
Well, they couldn't.
That's
the fact. And I asked myself years ago, when he was doing this, I just privately said to myself, mm-hmm. What other public figure could do this? And my answer, and I listed people, you know, Ted Kennedy and other senators,
Howard Baker kind of guy.
No one else could have done it. Why? Because Carter had both the unique capacity and the unique desire to get down in the weeds on it. He knew the history. He knew the religious.
Was his own faith a big part of that or not? The peacemaker, you know, blessed is a peacemaker, and
maybe in some, you know, from the 30,000.
Yeah, but not view, okay, but not.
But no. I mean, he as devoutly religious as President Carter is, he's not evangelical,
and he doesn't mix politics with that.
And he doesn't mix it up. And he also, I mean, you could go, let me tell you something, Jim. One of my favorite, I guess my favorite book of his, actually, that he wrote is, what was it called? Hour Before Daylight.
I haven't read that.
And it's a very personal little book that he published a few years ago, mm-hmm. about growing up in Plains, mm-hmm. and actually in Archery. that's where he lived to begin with, mm-hmm. Archery, Georgia, which is smaller than Plains. And talking about growing up there, and talking about his religious faith and how he came to be a born again Christian and so forth, and I realized as I was reading all that, mm-hmm. that he had never once, in all of my personal association with him, which began in 1967, he had never once brought his own personal religious faith or view of religion into any conversation about anything.
Interesting.
Religion is a deeply personal thing, uh-huh. and that's why a lot of the evangelicals during the Carter administration were against him, because he wouldn't be evangelical. He wouldn't, you know, he separation of church and state was what he was going to do, and they didn't want that. So he ironically, this most religious of presidents lost the evangelical right.
You know, he was so driven and put so much pressure on himself to be great. Does he feel he failed?
No.
He does not.
Absolutely not. He has regrets. Someone asked him, what would you do differently? He said, I would have had two more helicopters in the rescue mission.
But, you know, he was criticized for being too much of a micromanager there.
I don't know about that. I know that the very strong recommendation of the Defense Department was that we can do this. And I was not personally involved with that, so I can't speak of my own.
Might have gotten him reelected, right?
Yeah, I think it would have gotten him reelected. You know.
It's funny, you mentioned these things. He took a lot of risk that people forget.
Yes.
You know,
bringing a whole new energy policy to the country, saying, look, we have got in our own national interest, it's a national security issue.
By the way,
for us to be so dependent on foreign oil.
He ended up being a generation ahead of himself because we're just about to where his goals were trying to get us. You know,
we are
on the verge of energy independence.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, see, then he's criticized then for overloading Congress.
Yes,
with too much, trying to put that thing together.
But listen, here's another fact for you. Mm-hmm. There's only one modern president who had a higher degree of success legislatively.
I know, that's always an amazing fact.
Than Carter, and that was Johnson.
And you know what also amazes me is you have the image that Tip O'Neill hated all the Georgia folks, and I remember he's famously saying that Ham Jordan thinks you get speakers at Radio Shack.
Yeah.
But Tip O'Neill said he loved Carter and that he was brilliant.
He did. He said both things.
Yeah.
And the speaker called Hamilton Hannibal Jerkin.
Yeah, that's right.
but
Ham Jordan was just in the wrong.
The wrong man in the wrong job.
Exactly.
That's
where you have to criticize Carter, because Reagan, he could see that I can't put Ed Meese in that job because he's too disorganized.
And he put one of the best men in that job that's ever been in that
who
job.
Worked for an enemy.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that just shows a lot. I don't know, I think sometimes it's a disadvantage to be the smartest guy in the room.
Yes. And in my papers, I personally wrote a whole section on the organization of the White House in the transition documents that I delivered to the president.
What did you call for? A strong chief of staff or not?
Well, I had already discussed that with the president, and I knew that
he was not going to do that.
So I didn't do that because he and I had already discussed it, and he had been clear that that's not the direction he was going to go.
And it's because of Nixon, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, see, that's what...
The imperial president.
Exactly.
There's another reason, Jim. Yeah. There were seven of us, Hamilton Jordan, Stu Eisenstadt, Frank Moore,
Jody
Powell, and myself. So five.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Lipschutz was counsel, White House counsel.
Yep.
All of us had worked with Carter in different ways, in different capacities, for the years preceding the presidency.
So you thought it maybe could work.
And he did not want to pick a first among equals. Mm-hmm. That was a mistake. It was a serious mistake.
Serious mistake, yeah.
But that was, he didn't want to put someone between him and the other five or six. And the fact of the matter is that with the right kind of chief of staff, he wouldn't have been doing that. Having a very effective chief of staff who's doing his job doesn't mean that you have to be hauled
about. Oh, yes, exactly.
You know?
Did somebody tell him that you got to fix this, or just because everything fell apart around the malaise stuff?
A little bit of both. Do you know the name Charles Curbo?
Yes, I do. Who didn't want to go be on the staff permanently, right?
Yeah. Well, he could have been Attorney General if he'd wanted to be. He could have gone to the court.
When he told Carter, you've got to fix this.
Well, he said. I learned about this subsequently. I did not know this at the time, but mm-hmm. in the transition period, Curbo urged Carter to make me chief of staff.
Yeah.
And
I didn't get a chance to ask Jack, and I was going to ask it this way. If Carter had had a strong chief of staff from day one, would he have had a much more successful presidency?
Who knows? The answer to that is, who knows,
Jim?
That's
an honest answer, I guess.
You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell from our flagship station, JL Radio, WGCH, and WYBC.
Final national segment, part of the Georgia team behind President Carter, Jack Watson. Let me ask you this. It's an age-old question, and you guys, I think, tried both, which is presidents come in often saying, I want to have cabinet government, empowered, you know, agency heads, secretaries. We just talked about what happened when they didn't get quite along, versus total tight White House control. President Obama pretty much did it that way. Where do you come down on that? Where did the Carter administration come down on it?
I believe in Aristotle's golden mean, moderation in all things. It's a balance. Mm. The successful administration has a balance of power, a balance of authority, and delegation of responsibility and lead role between the White House and the cabinet agencies. The fact of the matter is, Jim, that the White House staff and the executive office of the president at large is tiny compared with the manpower and the budget, the monies that the departments have. So the truth is that any major policy is going to be executed by the departments and the agencies. It's not going to be executed by the White House. Mm-hmm. The White House's role is to make the goals clear, is to make the president's policies clear and why he's pursuing those policies, and then to see to it that the agencies are coordinating their implementation of the policy. This balance of power between the White House and the department heads is something that is difficult to achieve, but can be achieved, and I think we would get high marks on that in the Carter administration.
I also say Carter doesn't get much credit for this, but I think the most significant appointment made to fix and break the back of inflation, which from the 80s on is Paul Volcker.
Of course.
Best Fed chairman ever. And his decision to clamp down on the money supply, increase interest rates, cost him the election, along with Iran or whatever you want to go to. But that was another decision that he made, not in his own interest. Let me ask you this. We talked about FEMA. Is the Trump administration set up, and is the president ready to handle a crisis?
Most of the crises that we've dealt with so far, we, the country, the Trump administration, are self-imposed crises. We haven't really had an external crisis that tests the mettle of the president and the administration. And whether or not, when tested, and it will come, it inevitably comes, we'll see. I think the president has made some grave mistakes internationally in pulling out of alliances that have made the world work for the last 60 years, ever since World War II, 70 years. I think the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord, the withdrawal from the Iranian nuclear agreement, were bad decisions. They're wrong decisions. The undermining of NATO.
Pulling out of the TPP.
Pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, yes, TPP. The TPP pullout ceded authority, ceded power to China in that whole part of the world. The United States has been, since World War II, the leader of the free world. It is a role that is important to the world, and it is a role that we should not abdicate. And so many of the steps that the president has taken in the first 2 years of his administration are, in my judgment, respectfully stated, an abdication.
Let me ask you this. Do you have any prediction on the likelihood of success of Mick Mulvaney, the current chief of staff, who, by the way, seems to be smart enough to have kept the acting title with it?
The ability of Mr. Mulvaney to perform that job is dependent in largest measure on the delegation of authority and responsibility from the president for him to do it. I don't think that will be done, and therefore I don't think he can be successful.
Okay. President Carter may have been the first anti-Washington candidate to come out of the hinterlands from nowhere and win. Some might say that Trump is the natural outgrowth of that on the extreme basis. Do you see something that needs to happen to fix Washington?
There are no silver bullets. What fixes Washington is an active and engaged electorate, an informed body politic that cares about facts. A statement that Adlai Stevens had made in the 1950s that struck me as very wise said, "We need leaders who will talk sense to the American people." And then he went on to say, "But if we're to have such leaders, we need to be a people who refuse to listen to nonsense." We're listening to a lot of nonsense.
Good point.
These days. And you cannot have a successful democracy if people cannot agree on what the facts are. We cannot have a successful democracy, a successful Washington, a successful federal government, unless we respect the truth.
We've got a couple of minutes, so I want to be quick on a couple of things. First off, we talked about the innovations that Carter put in structurally. Two others were the role of the vice president and the role of the first lady. Talk about that a little bit.
Quickly, the first vice president in the history of the United States government to have an office in the West Wing of the White House where the president is was Walter Mondale. The relationship, the working collaborative relationship between Carter and Mondale was authentic and real and very effective. The two men respected each other greatly. The president relied on Mondale for countless things. He relied on him for his input of information. It was the creation of the modern vice presidency, in my view. As for the first lady, certainly the most active first lady probably in the history of modern America was Eleanor Roosevelt. But there have been other first ladies who were very significant in their roles, not so public as Eleanor. Rosalind and Jimmy have had one of the great partnerships that I've ever observed in my life. It's a great marriage, and it's a great partnership. And she was quietly in the background, keeping informed, stating her views and opinions to the president when she had one to state. And he took her views seriously. She was a wonderful first lady whose particular focus and priority was mental health.
Mental health. Okay, now in the last couple of seconds, tell us how they're both doing.
They're both doing well. The president will be 95 on October 1st of this year.
Wow.
Rosalind is 90, 91 maybe now. They're doing well. They're still building houses for Habitat. They're still traveling. And he's remarkable in that he's still giving speeches, still giving interviews. It's one of the wonders of the modern world.
And one of the best ex-president in the history of the United States.
I'd say so.
Thanks to former Carter White House Chief of Staff Jack Watson for a fascinating interview. You've been listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Thanks to our national audience for listening. We'll see everybody again next Sunday on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.